Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting, saying that Iran is not living up to the spirit of a two-year-old nuclear agreement it signed with Western powers. U.S. President Donald Trump has unveiled a new U.S. strategy toward Tehran in light of what he says is their non-cooperative nature.
We got weak inspections in exchange for no more than a purely short-term and temporary delay in Iran's path to nuclear weapons. What is the purpose of a deal that, at best, only delays Iran's nuclear capability for a short period of time? This, as President of the United States, is unacceptable.
Mr. Trump stopped short of pulling the United States out of the 2015 deal. Canadian Joshua Boyle, his wife and children, returned to Canada after being freed from the Akani network captivity by the Pakistan military, acting on a U.S. tip. Boyle spoke to reporters after landing in Canada about his family's losses.
The stupidity and the evil of the Haqqani network's kidnapping of a pilgrim and his heavily pregnant wife, engaged in helping ordinary villagers in Taliban-controlled regions of Afghanistan, was eclipsed only by the stupidity and evil of authorizing the murder of my infant daughter, Martyr Boyle.
The Haqqani network is Afghanistan's affiliate of Taliban. They abducted the Boyles while they were in Afghanistan in a 2012 backpacking trip. UN envoys from Britain and France called for Myanmar authorities to translate promises into action to end violence and create the conditions for the return of hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslim refugees. Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. U.S. military officials now urging Kurdish and Iraqi forces gathered on the outskirts of the disputed oil-rich city of Kirkuk to tone everything down as Kurdish officials continue to warn of an imminent Iraqi invasion. Scores of civilians have fled Raqqa ahead of an anticipated final push into the city by U.S.-backed fighters aiming to retake it from the Islamic State militants. Hundreds of civilians have been streaming out of Raqqa in the past few days from the remaining neighborhoods held by IS. They are taking advantage of a slowdown in the fighting by coalition troops meant to help civilians safely evacuate. Residents say local IS fighters have been surrendering in recent weeks, but still hold a few areas of the city, including the stadium and National Hospital. Coalition officials say that IS militants are still holding some civilians captive to use as human targets. Raqqa, on the banks of Euphrates River, is the de facto capital of the Islamic State fighters. European Union leaders could hand British Prime Minister Theresa May an olive branch and deadlock Brexit negotiations next week by launching their own internal preparations for transition to a new relationship with Britain.
The European Union's Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, declaring they were at an impasse.
This week we worked in a constructive spirit. We clarified certain points, without, however, making any great steps forward.
An internal draft document suggests free trade talks could begin in December. And if May ups her offers on divorce terms, the EU will be ready to crack on straight away. On Friday, European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker said Britain must commit to paying what it owes to the EU before talks can begin, and explained with new problems being found every day, the process will take longer than thought.
That's Reuters' Scarlett Satanovich reporting. Wildfires raging in the so-called wine country of the U.S. state of California appear to be combing and combining into one giant fire. The local fire chief says that his firefighters are facing more dry, windy conditions, which create a firefighting challenge. The blazes north of the city of San Francisco have killed 31 people since Sunday, while no one has yet heard from nearly half of the 900 people officially listed as missing. Authorities in the U.S. city of Las Vegas, Nevada, believe a mass shooter who targeted a country music concert in the city 2 weeks ago intentionally fired on a pair of nearby aviation fuel tanks. This news comes as police continue trying to sort out the basic information and facts surrounding the incident in which 58 people were killed and nearly 500 wounded. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington.
Can't pawn the people all the time. We have said we are not going to participate in that election. Obama was also saying very loudly, he will never leave that office.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta signs a controversial new electoral law Friday.
The highest court in the country declared that basically the suspension, or rather abandoning prosecution, was irrational, unlawful, and not constitutional.
A South African court says President Jacob Zuma can face prosecution over corruption charges.
We have seen how the government of Nigeria has gone all out, shooting people from helicopters as we speak. I have friends who have lost brothers in the same circumstance. I mean, these young men went outside just to demonstrate and they ended up dead.
And the UN Human Rights Office denounces the killings of demonstrators from the Cameroonian Anglophone community. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta signed the controversial electoral reform bill into law Friday. The new law stipulates that if a candidate withdraws from a repeat presidential election, the other aspirant would automatically win. The amendment also limits the ability of the Supreme Court to overturn election results and scraps the minimum requirement to be an Electoral Commission chairman. It also allows other commissioners to announce the results in the absence of the chairman. For reaction, I read Jakaya Midiwu, a Kenyan parliamentarian from the main opposition coalition, the National Super Alliance, or NASA, in the capital, Nairobi.
You know, you can't pawn the people all the time. We have said we are not going to participate in that election. Obama was also saying very loudly, he will never leave that office. What I think must happen in Kenya, the international community must accept that Kenyans cannot live together the way we have been living. We can only oppress people up to a certain limit. Kenya must be divided. Kenya must become two or three countries. Otherwise, what you're about to see is a lot of resistance for oppression. But you said after the election that the national community is giving Uhuru false confidence.
NASA's decision not to participate in the election, some are suggesting, literally hands over the presidency back to President Uhuru Kenyatta, and that it creates a disservice for the people of Kenya who went to the polls to cast their ballot, and the amount of money spent to organize the elections and the anticipated rerun. What do you say to that?
You can say that, but it is not with logic what you're saying. Because people went to the polls. Everybody knows who won. The winner of the elections was Raila Odinga. That's why they can never open the server. The difference between Uhuru and Raila in that server is nearly 2 million votes. It is not possible that Uhuru would allow rerun and Raila would be declared the winner. Because the people who stole Raila's vote are still there.
But Mr. Midiwu, if you are talking about separation, then it infringes upon Kenya's constitution, which calls for unity of the country. The demands being made by the NASA coalition, the main opposition party, some Kenyans are saying are unfounded because time is too short for the wholesome changes that NASA is demanding to be implemented before the October 26th elections. What do you say to that?
If it is about constitution, it is Ruto who opposed this constitution less than 10 years ago. We don't like the constitution. We want to live with constitution. As Kenyans, it is okay to live together as long as we were trying to develop ourselves toward a nationhood. But we haven't. It has failed. The Kikuyus don't like me as a Luo. I don't like them. The Canadians don't like me as a Luo. I don't like them. You can't force me to live with them.
So what is next for the NASA coalition? Because from the electoral reforms he signed, election is going to go ahead. Whether you like it or not, elections are going to be held. President Uhuru Kenyatta possibly could win. Then what's next for the NASA coalition?
He doesn't even have a credible opponent if he were to do it. It is illegal what he wants to do. And so for us, we'll never accept. You know, it's just going out to vote. It is accepting that Uhuru is our president. I can tell you without fear of contradiction that 50% of Kenyans are saying Uhuru is not their president. We don't like him. He is not capable. He is in the wrong office. The next thing we are going to do, Peter, from Monday, is to begin calling for economic boycotts. And you will see how far Kenya will go.
Jakaya Midiwo is a Kenyan parliamentarian from the main opposition coalition, the National Super Alliance, or NASA. He spoke with me from Nairobi. A South African court ruled Friday that President Jacob Zuma can face prosecution over corruption charges relating to a 1990 arms deal. The court ruled that the National Prosecution Authority erred in its decision to discontinue the corruption charges against Zuma. The South African president and some government officials were accused of taking kickbacks from a $5 billion purchase of fighter jets, patrol boats and other arms manufactured by European firms. Meanwhile, opposition parties are demanding the corruption charges against Zuma be reinstated following the court's ruling. For analysis, I reach constitutional law expert Shadrach Gutu, Professor Emeritus at the University of South Africa.
We are dealing with a situation where the matter went up to the Constitutional Court, which is the highest court in the country, and the highest court in the country declared that the suspension, or rather abandoning prosecution, was irrational and lawful and not constitutional. Then, of course, since then, President Jacob Zuma has been going to court after court after court, trying to ensure that his matter does not go to prosecution level. So the latest that we have is where the High Court did indicate that no, he can't have a right to appeal that decision.
The opposition parties, including the Democratic Alliance and the EFF, are basically calling for a court date. Do you think their demand is justified?
Their demand is based on the court rulings from the Constitutional Court downwards to the Supreme Court of Appeal down to the High Court rulings. So, yes, they do have a basis, but of course, you are talking about political parties here which are in the opposition and want to punish the ruling party, the African Russian Congress. And from that point of view, you will say we are dealing here with law and politics playing the game. And we don't know where it is going to go. But at this point, President Jacob Zuma is going to face probably prosecution. If the National Prosecuting Authority refuses to do so, it will be demanded that they issue a nolle prosequi case here to say we are not going to prosecute, and private prosecution may go forward. So he is not yet really protected, but neither do we know whether or not the National Prosecuting Authority will commence prosecution.
Professor Gutu, if indeed the National Prosecuting Authority decides to take up the case, how soon do you think corruption charges could be filed against Jacob Zuma? And if they refuse to do so, how soon do you think an independent prosecutor could be appointed to take up the case?
It will be a question of, does the National Prosecuting Authority set a date with the court, of course, on when the trial will proceed. So it is a question of the National Prosecuting Authority saying, yes, we are going to prosecute or not to prosecute. If they say they are going to prosecute, it is a question of dates being set up for prosecution to start. If they say no, it should be in writing so that there's private prosecution.
How damaging was this ruling to the ANC politically?
Politically, it is one which really destabilizes the African National Congress, that's the ruling party, since 1994. And indeed, it is one which has damaged the image of that party, and consecutively, it is under the leadership of Jacob Zuma, it is having fewer and fewer supporters, even though, or rather voters who vote for the African National Congress, although they still remain the majority, but the percentage of majority is going down steadily. And I think it is going to affect the African National Congress dearly in 2019 when we have national and provincial elections.
Shadrach Guto is Professor Emeritus at the University of South Africa. He spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. The UN Human Rights Office has denounced the killings of demonstrators from the Cameroonian Anglophone community in towns across the Northwest and Southwest regions. This as it calls for an impartial investigation into these events. Government figures put the numbers of deaths at about 10, but other estimates report many more people than that were killed. The UN human rights spokesman says credible sources indicate some of the deaths were caused by the excessive use of force by the security forces. For reaction, I read Sisiku Ayub Tabi, chairman of the Southern Cameroonian group demanding independence somewhere in Nigeria.
This is the same thing we have been calling on the world to do for the past year. Specifically, in the last couple of weeks, we have seen how the government of Mr. Biya has gone all out, shooting people from helicopters. As we speak, I have friends who have lost brothers in the same circumstance. I mean, the young men went outside just to demonstrate, and they ended up dead. And as we speak now, the government has even blocked the corpses of some of them from being taken because they don't want anybody to see what they have done. So we are happy that a call has been made for an investigation to be done. And trust me, the world is going to be appalled at the result of that investigation.
Sisiku, some supporters of the government are saying that this is the doing of the Anglophones because they are destabilizing the entire region because of the illegality that they are undertaking, despite efforts by the government to negotiate in good faith.
You just said negotiate. Who has the government been negotiating with? For 10 months, the government has not called the word negotiation. The negotiations ended on the 16th of January 2017. And on the 17th, they not only cancelled the negotiations, they banned the group, the people with whom they were negotiating. They took them and locked them up. They have been locked up for 8 months and counting. Some of them were released, 53 of them were released a couple of weeks ago. And the situation has been like that for since January. So we're talking about negotiation. Now, when you talk of illegality, we have to ask ourselves, is the call for justice, is the call for self-determination a call, a human right? If you say yes, then you can't be talking of illegality because all these people are asking for is a right to self-determination. It's to ask for what is rightfully there. So otherwise, the world would tell us that because we've been in this situation for 56 years, we might as well die as a second-class citizen. That's exactly the point we're making. And does it make sense that we have been subjugated for 56 years? Does that make it right? The answer is no.
There are concerns that so-called agitators in Bamenda have been torching schools because some parents decided they want to send their children to school. And because of that, these agitators have been torching down the schools. And because the government is mandated by the Constitution to protect life and property, that is why the security officers were sent to that area to ensure that government property are not destroyed.
That's the case, then we will not see schools that are protected by the same military. The schools are burned down, and within hours of the schools being burned down, the same government is proposing to rebuild the schools. Everything is orchestrated by this government to paint a black picture on the people who are demonstrating peacefully. The proof is that on the 22nd of September, our people went out with peace plans, and they were brutalized. We have video evidence of people walking out with their peace plans, and helicopters hovering over them, and you see the people shot and killed. Let's wait for the independent investigation. That's the best thing that has happened to our cause.
So what is next for your group?
For my group, what we are doing is, well, we are happy that an independent investigative team will go. When they find out We expect the United Nations Security Council to say, listen, finally, let's know how many of these people really want this by giving them a chance for a referendum. That is the least the United Nations should ask. And when they do, we are very certain that our people will express in no uncertain terms their desire to be their own nation.
What are the prospects of a possible referendum, looking at the fact that some say the unity is non-negotiable, as they said?
That Mr. Biya's utterances. But the question we are asking is not to Mr. Biya, it's the world, asking the world. If the United Nations believes that Mr. Biya has to play God on the 8 million people who happen to come from a different nation, then so be it. But what we are saying is, if they go down the route of giving us the right to self-determination, which is a human right, then we are certain. We can tell you the results of those the referendum. The results will be overwhelmingly in support of the fact that those people should form their own nation.
You are very confident about that. Why?
Because I've seen the people go out, even in spite of the government intimidation, the people have gone out to express themselves. I will tell you, I was comforted the other day when a young man called me and told us that when they realized that the military were coming to brutalize their village, his old father, who's 86 years old, took his cutlass. He was running into the bush with his stick. He was walking stick. And he turned, he said the last words his father told him is, I'm going, I might not come back. But what Sisiku and the people are trying to give you is something you should die for. And that father has been gone for 2 weeks. They have not seen the man. He left his home on the 30th of September. We pray that he will find him. When he's gone and he's lost in the bush somewhere, he left his children with a message that they must fight for something that he could not live to enjoy.
Sisiku Ayuk Tabe is the chairman of the Southern Cameroonian group demanding independence. He spoke with me from an undisclosed location in Nigeria. Meanwhile, the Cameroonian government has launched a probe into recent deadly violence linked to a symbolic declaration of independence in the English-speaking region. The Cameroonian Ministry of Defense said on Friday that security forces did not open fire during the demonstrations. Dr. Fonte Akum is a senior researcher at the Institute of Security Studies in Pretoria. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached him in N'Djamena and began by asking him about the seriousness of the Cameroon Anglophone crisis.
The Cameroon Anglophone crisis has gotten more serious as the months have passed and as the crisis has remained unresolved because, as you're very well aware, a lot of the issues began around the lawyers asking for a translation of a specific legal code and the teachers complaining about the way in which the Anglophone educational system was being subjected to external influences, particularly the Francophonization of the educational system. The response of the government was kind of tepid at the beginning, and then it was followed by the arrest of the leaders of the consortium and cutting off of the internet for the Anglophone provinces. And since then, I think that it's spiraled out of control. And though we don't see that there is a possibility for resolution beyond dialogue.
Given the government's response up to this point, where there have even been people who have been killed, do you think the government is handling it right?
I would not say that the government is handling it right, but let's put everything in context. If you look at the situation in Anglophone Cameroon today, it's fair to say that you have a young group of individuals, and this is not just about Anglophones or Francophones. You have a generation of Cameroonians who are denied opportunities, right, and who are engaging with a government which is a lot older and which has been there for pretty much over 35 years. If you take those things into consideration, there is a part of it which amounts to lost in intergenerational translation, where I don't think they're speaking the same language and they're looking at the issues the same way. I think that when they bridge this generational gap, amongst other things, as well as the cultural undertones and the historical factors that undergird it, then we would start moving forward towards potential and durable resolution.
Talking of a generational gap, do you think that maybe governance issues may be at the root of this conflict?
Absolutely. Governance issues are at the root of this conflict, and they are not just governance issues which affect Anglophones and the marginalization of Anglophones, which is very important. I'm not trying to minimize it. But there are also governance issues that affect the complete centralization of power in Yaoundé. As you're aware, a civil servant, for example, who served the government in Marwa, upon retirement, and I'm talking about the extreme north of the country, upon retirement and to have access to his pension, actually has to travel all the way to Yaoundé to follow up the process. So there's that issue of complete centralization in Yaoundé administrative center, which raises a number of governance issues that even go beyond the fact that there is one particular regime that has been in power for 35 years. And within these 35 years, they have succeeded in creating a system where the same ruling party, the Cameroon's People Democratic Movement, which was born in Bamenda, coincidentally, in the Anglophone part of Cameroon in 1985, has actually maintained a grip on power since the advent of multi-party politics in Cameroon in 1990. So their governance issues, their issues with representation, their issues with accountability, their issues with opportunities for growth and advancement within Cameroon's system, their issues of octogenarians leading the country and not giving room to another generation to actually succeed them, and then their issues with the kinds of decisions that are being made to maintain the regime in place. So all these issues coalesce to create sort of a governance cocktail against which we've seen the Anglophones pushing on this side. But obviously, it's something which I think affects a lot of Cameroonians.
How do you see this being resolved in the short term?
Honestly, in the short term, I don't see it being resolved because for it to be resolved, there needs to be a clarity of thought and a clarity of vision. So in the short term, unless concessions are made on both sides, I do not see it being resolved.
Dr. Fonte Akum is a senior researcher at the Institute of Security Studies in Pretoria. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from the Chadian capital in N'Djamena. A new study that shocked researchers shows that most people in poor and middle-income countries suffer unimaginable pain without any help. The results of a study on pain and pain management motivated the research group to find a way to help the millions of people who suffer needlessly. VOA's Carol Pearson has more from Washington.
Some years ago, Felicia Knoll had a mastectomy to treat breast cancer.
I woke up from a mastectomy and I remember the horror of the pain of not being able to breathe. And yet I got access almost immediately to pain relief, which allowed me to push through it much more easily.
Knoll is a professor at the University of Miami School of Medicine. Her postoperative pain provided a catalyst to study pain management on a global level.
When I thought about other women going through this, when I thought about children burn victims and having their wounds dressed and cleaned and the agony of that without pain relief, and then when I found out how inexpensive it is to solve this problem, a real win-win in global health, that was when we really decided to move forward.
Knoll chaired an international study on pain relief, published in The Lancet. The results shocked even the researchers.
We looked across the world using, as a tracer, access to morphine, and more than 100 countries could satisfy less than 30% of need for pain relief just for palliative care alone. And in fact, the vast majority have almost nothing.
What's more, low- and middle-income countries pay more than five times the amount countries like the U.S. pay for morphine, the cheapest available medication to address severe pain. Knoll says if all countries paid the same price, $145 million would close the pain gap between rich and poor countries. Knoll has enlisted the help of Dr. Jim Yong Kim, president of the World Bank. Kim has pledged to help change what he called a dire situation. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, recently said that Mozambique has admitted to having over $1 million of undisclosed debt. The two sides were now evaluating the implications of this disclosure. This prompted the IMF to demand Mozambique explains critical information gaps over $2 billion of secret government loans in a scandal that has affected the nation's economy. A recent audit by the New York-based forensic accountant Kroll concluded that $500 million of the $2 billion was still unaccounted for. Denise Namburet is coordinator for the Mozambican Budget Monitoring Forum. She joins me live in the studios. Hello, Denise.
Hello, Peter.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. So tell me, how was the government able to hide the debt?
The debts were privately contracted. Although they have guaranteed by the government of Mozambique, they were actually not submitted to the Assembly of the Republic for assessment, approval, and monitoring. So the non-submission of the debts to the General Assembly was a violation of the Constitution of Mozambique, according to which it is its exclusive competency to authorize the government, you know, to define general conditions, to contract grant loans, and perform other credit operations. So somehow it was hidden from the parliament, therefore from the whole country.
How did Mozambicans react when this came out?
It was outrageous. We had demonstrations with a lot of repression, as always, from the government. We had a lot of conversations on social media. We had the media putting pressure for disclosure, full disclosure of the information, especially because right in the beginning when US-based media published information about the debt, Mozambican government authorities were over and over saying it was a lie, there were no hidden debts. So there was a lot of pressure from Mozambican society to get the information until we somehow, the IMF, requested the audit.
So far, has the government been able to at least explain to meet the requirement of the IMF? Because I understand the IMF will not give them any more funds or coordinate or partner with them if there is no transparency moving forward or accounting for the debt that has been hidden. Hidden loans, as they call it in Mozambique.
Exactly. In fact, the hidden loans, what the audit report says is that 2/3 of the 2 billion has gone unaccounted for. Therefore, the IMF, according to the information we have from the IMF, they're expecting the Mozambican government to provide information on, you know, what has been done with these 2/3 of the debt, which it's equivalent to the Mozambican GDP, so it's huge, you know. So basically what we as civil society organizations are demanding, it's for the Credit Suisse, the VTB, mm-hmm. The banks involved in this scheme, and the authorities in Mozambique to fill the information gaps that are in the audit report so that we are able to start demanding accountability from the prosecutors in Mozambique.
Has the government been forthcoming? How cooperating have they been since civil society groups like yours have been demanding more explanation and transparency in this scandal?
Not at all. We actually believe that the government was expecting, you know, that the IMF, you know, the World Bank, the donors of Mozambique were going to be satisfied as long as the audit was conducted. But we are not satisfied. The donors have not resumed their support to the Mozambican state budget, which they have cancelled last year. All this year, 2017, Mozambique has been, you know, the country has been running without donor support. And the government is still expecting the donors to come back, but I don't think they will. We actually brought a number of conditions that we would like IMF to take on board before negotiating any further credit to the Mozambican government, which includes, you know, conditions around the need for annual fiscal assessment of the fiscal environment of the country, risk assessment, of the microeconomic environment. We also demanding a plan of action through which we'll be able to understand what kind of measures towards accountability the government is taking. We also want to understand the measures around austerity. There are a lot of budget cuts happening, and we want to make sure that the cuts do not affect, you know, social services area, do not affect the gains that we had the last few years in terms of budget allocation to the, you know, to social services, to water, health, education sectors. So the budget cuts that we have seen so far somehow affecting these areas, and it's having a great impact in the poorest communities. So what we want is to, you know, that these kind of conditions are taken in consideration by the MAF before resuming any conversations with the Mozambican government.
Denise, let me ask you, a prominent lawyer that I'm sure you are aware of, who represented the Mozambican state-owned companies, argued in a recent interview that it is, quote, impossible to transfer these values of money without the IMF and the World Bank knowing about it. What do you make of his argument?
It's actually very funny. We don't know what the IMF and the World Bank knew before demanding full disclosure from the government of Mozambique. But we welcome IMF decision to demand the audit. You know, I believe donors were very curious. Even if the IMF knew, most of the donors, especially from the funding the state budget, they didn't know. So as well as the, you know, the constitution, Mozambican population. So we don't know if the IMF knew, but we welcome the decision to have a full report on these debts.
This lawyer is saying that there were no hidden debts. Now, this despite the fact that 10 IMF officials were sent to Maputo. They said they were displeased with explanations given to them by the administration. What did you hear, and what are you demanding from the government about this scandal?
We all the narrative about not having hidden debts has been very common in Mozambique, you know, right in the beginning of this crisis. But somehow the government came forward and they said, yes, we recognize there was, in the beginning, they only recognized the debt with Ematung. And then the other two debts came to the public, and then they had to come back to the IMF to recognize the other two debts. So the government has been always, you know, withholding information and not wanting to disclosure all the information.
Well, usually they say it's a matter of national security, so
that's the argument they've been using. But then it's a matter of national security, which somehow the Mozambican citizen will have to pay for this debt. He's already paying because the government has made two payments already on this debt. So we have the right to know as citizens, you know, what exactly the kind of debts they've contracted to, you know, what for. We have that right. So I don't believe that the argument they use is strong enough to withhold information the way they have been doing.
Do you think the civil society groups have been putting pressure enough on the government to release some of this information that you demand? Because some critics are saying that civil society groups like yours have not been doing quite enough. What do you say to that?
We have been doing the better we can do in the conditions we are given. As you know, Mozambique has been under severe repression for the last three years since this issue, you know, exploded. We had people that were killed, were shot dead. We had people, there is a lot of repression every time citizens try to protest. We see a lot of violations of some of the most basic rights to assembly, you know, to freedom of expression, you know. So there is a lot of repression of civil society space to voice their concerns regarding this issue. And that somehow is affecting civil society ability to put more pressure. We have been putting, you know, the maximum pressure we can. I believe there's a lot we can do. But at the same time, we don't think we have, we feel safe enough, you know, to put the necessary pressure to the government. And I don't believe only through the pressure from civil society, the government will provide and take the necessary steps to you know, to clear this issue. I think all the other sectors of society, the media, private sector, you know, even sections from the government, from the state, everyone has to come together and put pressure so that we have disclosure, you know, of this case.
Denise, before we leave, what has been your group's observation so far regarding how current funds are being moved around in terms of usage?
All that you know is provided by the Kroll's report. There is no information about how the money has been used, and that's the main ask from the IMF, and of course it's also the main ask from Mozambican civil society. There is a conversation in Mozambique which says that the money has never reached, you know, the central bank in Mozambique was never through our banking system, therefore it's not easy to trace in Mozambique. But we don't know. We don't have official positioning from the government in this regard.
Thank you very much. Denise Nambret is the coordinator for the Mozambican Budget Monitoring Forum. She joined me live here in the VOA studios in Washington. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy. You are one and no. Sisi Ferrari, oh. Baby sweet, baby nice, baby tootie tootie, body quite tight. Show me more sexy, mala robo ya roni. Oti makode wapa, o afe makuka semi. Baby,
You suppose like what you see. But the enemies, they made. Tell me why they made. I feel like food, no one job. Tell me why they made for love. Jealousy, jealousy. Solo Makinde, I go see. I know might make you see. Alibaba, God, they bless we.
My bank account done, turn the rubber. All the fine girls, turn the wrong come. They don't waste time to shake the bum bum. Ricky Fresco, Ricky Tom Tom. Fatty bum bum, money don't come. I don't jump up, no they best for me. I see, sell them round two. Money they worry me, so I don't worry them.
Baby, let them, they plenty for time. Hey. Plenty for that, hey. Beg for you, there plenty for that, hey. Oh, there plenty for that, hey. Olo she, there plenty for that, hey. There plenty for that, hey. Luku, there plenty for that. Oh, yeah, see them, see them, there plenty for that.
Come on, pa. And other stars, then they feel my demo. Luku, them, I look me, him. Now the prince of FVZ. No be rice, no be beans, eh. Make you no mind anything them talk. Make you no mind anything they yeah. I don't go talk anything they lie. But now you get your life, oh.
The more you look, the less you see. No fun for gutter as you are looking at me. You they do your face like Winchy Winchy. Now you won't follow me, count diamonds in you.
I don't see me so, I they shiny, shiny.
My baby self, she they shiny, shiny. Only came for my hand, I can borrow you. I've been left, you for ground, no go.
Everybody come close, oh. Sorry, what? So, man, I'll be on it, oh. Cause you wish me well, oh, well, oh. You must follow me, Jock. From Niger to Yankee. Overland, overseas. Open doors, I they see. Where is the master key?
Tisha, all the man, them. When I hear me, all the girl, them. When I hear me, call Alacha. Where Alachi? Left the don't rest. Plenty achi,
getting money or plenty. Looky, looky, looking at me or plenty. Now we getting money or plenty. Makachuku, my pocket, no go empty.
Make the fire burn all the enemies.
Make the fire burn all the enemies.
Look, look, put them just to follow me.
Look, look, put them just to follow me.
Let's cross out you in Nagala.
Ferrari, you don't get any choice but to marry. Hey, I'm gonna give you the khaki. Hey.
avec moi. Vous dansez avec moi.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the water of the river flows on without waiting for the thirsty man. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On October 4th, the Iraqi security forces, supported by the U.S.-led global coalition to defeat ISIS, liberated the town of Hawija and over 150 surrounding villages from ISIS, along with as many as 85,000 civilians who had been trapped there. Hawija was the terrorist group's last stronghold in northern Iraq. ISIS has now lost control of almost all the territory it once held in Iraq, except for a small area in western Anbar along the Euphrates River Valley and out to Al-Qaim, located on the Iraqi-Syrian border. ISIS seized Hawija during its 2014 offensive in northern Iraq that also resulted in the fall of the strategically important cities of Sinjar, Tal Afar, and Mosul. By the end of 2014, ISIS declared Mosul to be its capital in Iraq. To counter the terrorist group's rapid expansion and begin rolling it back, the United States and partner nations formed a global coalition that countered ISIS with a series of airstrikes in September 2014. Over the past 3 years, the coalition liberated the captured cities and destroyed ISIS in its safe havens, hamstrung its capacity to generate revenue through theft of local resources, antiquities, and oil, and hobbled its ability to recruit foreign fighters, move funds, and spread false propaganda over the internet and social media. Ultimately, the coalition's support enabled Iraqi security forces to take on ISIS and defeat the terrorist organization. Hawija is the latest ISIS-held city in Iraq to be liberated. A similar campaign is even now in progress in Syria, where U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces are in the midst of an all-out assault on the city of Raqqa, ISIS's Syrian capital. The Iraqi security forces continue to prove they are a battle-hardened professional force dedicated to ridding their country of an evil enemy, said the coalition in a written statement. While the liberation of Hawija is a significant milestone, an ISIS presence remains in Iraq, and the coalition will continue to stand side by side with the ISF in their collective mission to defeat ISIS.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.